The Guardian.
A scientist and his team out of Oregon are reportedly the first US-based group to successfully edit the DNA of human embryos.
For billions of years, life on Earth has been shaped slowly and incrementally by the unseen forces of natural selection.
The world of genetics was discovered in the US out of Oregon Health and Science.
But a paper published this month showed how this could be about to change.
Kazakhstan native was previously known for unveiling the world's first cloned monkeys back in 2007.
A US-Korean team showed that gene editing could be used to mend heart disease mutations in human embryos for the first time.
The team didn't allow the embryos to develop past a few days.
This demonstration could ultimately lead to entirely new treatments for genetic disease. But it also poses profound ethical questions about what it means to be human.
Those eggs were then fertilized with this gentleman's sperm, and at the same time that we injected the sperm, we introduced CRISPR to make a cut in the DNA at the site of this gene mutation. And then we analyzed the embryos, and we were able to show that with reasonably high efficiency, the mutation was corrected.
Because of the fraught nature of disagreement and at these ethical boundaries, any attempt to draw a boundary is undoubtedly going to draw criticism, but it doesn't mean that we can't attempt to draw them.
Hello.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
Hey, Max.
How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
To find out more about the landmark study, I spoke to one of the scientists who was involved in the research.
I'm Paul Amato. I'm an associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology and a reproductive endocrinologist at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon.
I spoke to Paula down the line this week, and I started by asking her about the gene editing technique known as CRISPR that was used in the work.
Sure. CRISPR has been described as like a molecular scissors. So it's essentially a molecular compound that can go into a cell, and it has a guide that tells it where to cut, and it can make cuts in the DNA. And this has two purposes. One, you can induce mutations in the DNA if that's your desired outcome, or in our case, you can use it to try and help correct a gene mutation.
And could you just take us through which gene mutation you were targeting in your recent study?
So we were working on a gene called MYBPC3, and this gene is one of the most common causes of a condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. This is a heart condition that can lead to an enlarged heart and result in some cases in heart failure and sudden cardiac death, especially in young people.
Right. And so in your study, you were looking at this mutation in human embryos. Could you just take me through what you did exactly?
Sure. So we recruited a gentleman who was known to carry a mutation in this gene. He had one abnormal copy of the gene and one normal copy, so-called heterozygous. And then we recruited several young, healthy egg donors, and those egg donors underwent ovarian stimulation and egg retrieval, very much like we would do for in vitro fertilization or IVF for women undergoing fertility treatment. Those eggs were then fertilized with this gentleman's sperm, and at the same time that we injected the sperm, we introduced CRISPR to make a cut in the DNA at the site of this gene mutation. And then we analyzed the embryos, and we were able to show that with reasonably high efficiency, the mutation was corrected.
There's been a huge amount of interest in your work, and it's not the first time that scientists have carried out gene editing in embryos. There's been three studies, I think, from Chinese groups that have taken a similar approach. Could you just tell us how your work differed and why it was an advance on those previous papers?
The previous Chinese studies, a couple of them used abnormal embryos, so embryos that had an abnormal complement of chromosomes, which obviously wouldn't be suitable for transfer to make a baby. And one study used immature eggs that are normally discarded in the process of in vitro fertilization. So our study was the first to use mature eggs or high quality eggs like we would use for IVF. That was one important difference. Secondly, we analyzed a large number of embryos, dozens of embryos, whereas the Chinese study were dealing with just a handful of embryos.
Right. So is it fair to say that your work was the first to produce embryos that would be potentially viable if you were to take that step?
Yes, although with the immature eggs, it's theoretically possible to mature those eggs in the petri dish and then produce a viable embryo, although that process is very inefficient and is not usually done. So I would say this is the first study with clinical high-quality eggs.
Paula and her colleagues also wanted to investigate some of the potential concerns around whether CRISPR gene editing can be done safely enough to be used clinically in the future.
Two of the concerns or problems that have plagued previous studies on CRISPR are the issue of mosaicism, and this is a situation where the different cells in the embryos may contain different gene complements, meaning some of the cells may have two normal copies of the gene and some of the cell may still have an abnormal copy of the gene. So obviously that would not be desirable because that could cause disease in a baby. The other issue that people worry about is something called off-target effects, and that's when the CRISPR scissors, if you will, cuts the DNA in other areas of the genome other than the intended target. And obviously that can induce mutations and cause additional problems. So what we did is we introduced CRISPR at the time of sperm injection into the egg, and that seemed to overcome the issue of mosaicism. In almost all our embryos, all the cells in the embryos we analyzed had two normal copies of the gene. And then we did look for off-target effects using a process called whole genome sequencing. That's where we sequenced the entire DNA of the embryo, and we did not observe any off-target effects. So that was, again, different from previous studies. So both those things were reassuring to us in terms of the potential safety of this, but obviously it doesn't prove that it would be safe, but it is at least reassuring.
On the off-target effects, are there other things that could happen apart from other unwanted SNPs in the DNA, say, that would come up on that whole genome sequencing thing? Are there other things that can happen?
Those are the main things. So, you know, if it cuts in other areas of the DNA, the potential consequences are huge. They could be innocuous, but they could also induce mutations that could lead to other diseases that, you know, different from the one we're trying to cure.
I suppose my question really is, how sure can you be through doing these kind of checks that there haven't been other changes introduced to the DNA of the embryo?
Yeah, it's possible that the methods that we use for screening for these off-target effects may miss some. That's certainly a possibility. There's also something called epigenetic effects, and that's when you might not change the sequence of DNA, but you change the expression of that DNA, and that can result into problems. So to date, we have not done any studies on the epigenetic effects, but that would be important as well.
And so what's the path forward from here? There's obviously a potential clinical benefits for this kind of approach, assuming that, you know, you are able to rule out those off-target effects and other risks. What's the next step towards that?
Well, I still think there needs to be more basic research done on this. So obviously we would want to reproduce this study. We would want to look at other gene mutations. And what we found in our study was that the embryo used the normal copy of the gene that came from the egg as a template to correct the mutation, and it did not use the external DNA, synthetic DNA template that we had provided. So that's different from other cell types. So given that, if the embryo had two abnormal copies of the gene, which could happen in some cases, we don't think this CRISPR mechanism would work. So we would like to obviously figure out a way to correct so-called homozygous gene mutations when there's two abnormal copies of the gene. And also our efficiency was around 72%, so 72% of the embryos were corrected. And that's pretty good, but obviously we would like to optimize that and have it be closer to 100%.
Gene editing of human embryos is probably still at least a decade away from the clinic. But experts are already mapping out the social and ethical implications of the technology in intricate detail. Something we'll hear about after this short break.
So not just this particular person who would grow from that embryo, but that person's children and their children's children and so on and so on. So the consequences of getting that wrong are potentially really profound.
We'll also hear about the role the law plays.
And one of the advantages of the law and the legal system is that it recognises the importance of drawing clear boundaries, even if they are to some extent arbitrary.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean. Apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, make sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we heard from Paula Amato, one of the co-authors of a recent study in which human embryos were genetically modified to rid them of mutations that are known to cause heart failure. Editing the genetic code of human embryos could one day help parents avoid passing on devastating genetic diseases to their children. But it would also take society into completely uncharted territory.
I'm good. I can only see a guardian symbol. Do you want me just to go into audio?
This is Karen Young.
So I'm a professor of law and director of the Centre for Technology, Ethics, Law and Society at the Dixon Poon School of Law at King's College London. And I'm also currently chair of the Nuffield Council on Bioethics Working Group on Genome Editing and Human Reproduction.
I spoke to Karen via Skype this week. And I started by asking her how she reacted to the recent paper.
Well, obviously, I'm not a scientist, so I can't really speak to the significance in scientific terms, although it was pretty clear that it generated enormous excitement in terms of proof of principle. But for non-scientists, for lawyers and ethicists, the reason why it's particularly important is it brings us one step closer to the real possibility or prospect that this might be developed to such an extent that it would be safe enough to contemplate actually using it in the clinic and using it for those kinds of purposes to affect future generations.
And what is the law at the moment around where this can be used? The research that was done in the US, this was in embryos, and that's obviously still a significant step away from having babies born with these kind of genetic modifications. What's the law around it at the moment?
Right. So in the UK, the legal position is very clear, and research involving human embryos is legally permitted, but it's very tightly regulated by the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority. And so there's an act, the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act of 1990, which permits researchers to undertake research on human embryos subject to certain quite stringent conditions. And they have to get prior approval first by the regulatory authority before they can proceed with this kind of research. So that is permissible, subject to certain conditions. But the implantation of an embryo that has been modified would be a criminal offence under British legislation. And my understanding is that the position is similar in the US, although it's not regulated in the same way. It's possible in the US to undertake research on human embryos subject to ethical oversight and review, but it, again, is not legally possible to implant them in a woman in order to produce a live birth.
And so I think you've already touched on the idea that there are obviously potentially big benefits to the technology in the future in terms of being able to possibly eradicate certain genetic diseases, or at least give families with these diseases new options for having children. But there are also a lot of ethical concerns around the technology and around the sort of broader social risks that might be posed. Could you just talk through what some of those are?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I guess one of the things that we should start with is that if you think about the most likely prospect of using these technologies, then it would make sense that we first approach them to try and correct for very serious single genetic disorders. That would be the kind of obvious candidate. And so if we're thinking about people in that position, it's helpful to bear in mind that for a great majority of people who suffer from these kinds of conditions, there is already current techniques that can assist them in having genetically related children using pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So embryos are created in an IVF procedure, and then clinicians select those that are identified as not suffering from the condition. So we're really only talking about a relatively small number of people when we only focus on using these kind of techniques in relation to those kinds of disorders. So I think it's important to bear in mind that that's probably where it would start should society take the view that it's okay to go ahead with these kinds of interventions. So having said that, even if we confine our attention to this group of cases, I guess that the first and most important issue is the question of safety. So because this has never been tried before, there are enormous number of unknowns about whether or not it would be safe to use this procedure and produce the intended consequences. And one of the reasons that why that is such a pressing issue is that we're not talking about a treatment to an individual live patient that will only affect that person. So if we were thinking about using these techniques as a therapeutic intervention for a live patient who suffered from a particular genetic disorder, then even if things didn't go as planned, only that individual patient would be affected. But once we start thinking about intervening in human embryos, in the so-called germline, then it's really important to recognize that this means that any of those changes would affect all of the subsequent generations to come. So not just this particular person who would grow from that embryo, but that person's children and their children's children and so on and so on. So the consequences of getting that wrong are potentially really profound.
Until now, introducing any genetic changes that would be passed on through generations has been completely off limits. But is all that about to change?
My understanding is that the primary reason for that ethical boundary marker is because of those reasons of safety, that we just simply couldn't contemplate that we might be able to develop techniques that would enable us to make interventions at that level of safety. But let's assume that we might possibly one day get to the stage where we could satisfy ourselves that it would be safe enough to try. And even if we leave aside those safety concerns, there are still a number of other ethical concerns that are expressed, quite apart from safety, concerning intervention in the human germline. And so, for example, one of the concerns that's frequently raised in these kinds of debates is the prospect of eugenics. And of course, eugenics has a bad press because it's associated with the appalling attempts by the Nazi regime to engineer population-wide changes. But even if we leave aside those dreadful coercive interventions, there's a much sort of softer concern that still resonates with concerns that appear in worries about eugenics, about the fact that we might, if we go down this path, we might become a sort of selecting society. And then in becoming a selecting society, we might be signifying particular kinds of attitudes towards people with traits that are regarded as unwanted that we don't, as a society, collectively wish to subscribe to. And that's a really real concern in debates about intervention for the purposes of editing out unwanted traits and disabilities and diseases in particular.
Karen, I'm really interested in where you stand on that. I interviewed Jennifer Doudna recently, who was one of the inventors of CRISPR, and she told me that her view had changed quite significantly on the clinical applications. And at first, she'd been mostly very against the possibility and very concerned about the risks, but she's shifted to thinking that there's situations where it would be wrong not to use the technology. And she said it was partly because of the huge number of emails and letters that she gets from parents of children with very severe genetic diseases where you know, their children are suffering. What do you think about that? Do you think there is an ethical case that you ought to use the technology to spare suffering?
Well, I'm just going to emphasise that I'm speaking personally here from my own personal opinion, and I'm not representing any other body in putting forward my own view. I think there's clearly an ethical case to recognise that if we have the capacity to relieve human suffering, then that is a very strong justification for adopting that intervention. So I think there is a very strong case where it is very clear that we have the capacity to ameliorate human suffering. But on the other hand, we have to take into account the wider consequences of proceeding along that path. And those are not decisions I think that we can take lightly. And in particular, I think because they have the capacity to fundamentally affect our self-understanding and the kind of moral culture of our community, it becomes enormously important that the public are really actively involved in reflecting upon whether this is what we want to do or not.
One open question is where to draw the line between prevention of disease and human enhancement. Take the example of a degenerative muscle disorder, where when you correct the genetic defect, you make a person stronger than average. Is that acceptable?
Your question is touching upon a very familiar debate in the kind of bioethical arguments about whether or not it's permissible to engage in the enhancement of human traits and to use these kinds of interventions for purposes that are clearly not traditionally understood as therapeutic. And you quite rightly point to the fact that sometimes a clearly therapeutic intervention may have other beneficial side effects, which are in a sense a bonus. And what should we do about those? And how do we draw some lines? And I guess the truth is, it's not possible to draw perfectly clear ethical boundaries to only catch those kinds of situations that you very clearly endorse and those that you don't. But I guess that's because the real world is messy. And one of the advantages of the law and the legal system is that it recognises the importance of drawing clear boundaries, even if they are to some extent arbitrary. So to give you a classic example, the law has to decide at what point somebody becomes a legally competent adult and becomes legally responsible for your actions. And the law is very clear. When you get to the age of 18, you become an adult. And even though we know that it's true that not all 18-year-olds have the kind of emotional and mental maturity to accept full legal responsibility for their actions, the law recognises that they are nonetheless. So boundaries are inevitably imperfect when we apply them in the real world to real situations, but that's not a new phenomenon, and this particular context is simply another example of that. Now, what it does suggest is that because of the fraught nature of disagreement and these ethical boundaries, any attempt to draw a boundary is undoubtedly going to draw criticism, but it doesn't mean that we can't attempt to draw them.
It's not just ethicists and legal experts like Karen who are considering the ethics of gene editing. Scientists like Paula Amato have a responsibility too.
Well, I'm personally very interested and concerned about the ethical issues, and before we even started this study, we had a great deal of discussions about that, and the study protocols underwent extensive review, including by an ethics committee. for me, the biggest issue is safety. So can we be sure that this will be safe? And as you say, whatever gene modification we make in this embryo will then be passed on to future generations. So, you know, it may take years, generations, to be able to figure out if this is truly safe. The issue of designer babies and eugenics comes up all the time, every time there seems to be some advance in reproductive technology. And those concerns, while I think they're important for us to think about, I think are much further off, because when you talk about using this technology for enhancement purposes, so not for the prevention of genetic diseases, but to kind of increase things like intelligence or athleticism, I think that's much more difficult to do. First of all, we don't know the genes that are responsible for those traits, and it's not likely to be a single gene. It's probably many genes. And then secondly, if this mechanism that we describe is really the way it works, you can't easily put in a better gene to replace the gene that you had there. It seems like the embryo has its own repair mechanism, and at best, it will use the normal copy of the gene from whichever parent as a template to correct the mutation. So I think those concerns are a little further off. I do think there needs to be oversight, because the potential consequences are so potentially deleterious and significant. I'm a little conflicted, to be honest, because every time there's a new reproductive technology that comes on board, people get very nervous about it. And when you think about when IVF was first introduced, if this same type of regulation existed then, it would have delayed the implementation of those therapies for perhaps decades. And then when I think of all the millions of babies that potentially would not have been born, because luckily those technologies turned out to be safe, so I'm a little conflicted. Although, weighing everything, I think strict regulation and oversight is probably the way to go.
Special thanks this week to Paula Amato and Karen Young. If you want to find out more, we'll include a link to the original Nature paper in the episode's description on The Guardian's website. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.